welcome to the Athenaeum Review podcast, where we talk about the ideas that shape our world. I'm Ben Lima, and our guest today is Catherine Kraft, who's curator at the Nasher Sculpture Center and a scholar of modern art movements including Dada, Surrealism, Abstract Expressionism, and Neo-Dada. She recently curated The Nature of Art at the Nasher, which will open at the Peggy Guggenheim Collection in Venice in April, as well as the touring exhibition Melvin Edwards' Five Decades in 2015. As well as the accompanying catalogs for both shows. She's also the author of the books An Audience of Artists, Dada, Neo-Dada, and the Emergence of Abstract Expressionism, published by University of Chicago Press, and Robert Rauschenberg, published by Phaidon Press. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me to come and talk with you.
Well, I wanted to start by asking about ARP, and in particular, his interest in this idea of nature, where he's not interested in the illusionistic substitutes for nature, i.e. landscape painting or representing nature, but it seems that he sort of sees nature as a kind of force within the work of art, the kind of generation, production, metamorphosis, this sort of thing. And he it sounds like he sees his works of art as kind of natural objects in a way. And so I wanted to ask you, can you tell us a little about kind of maybe where he got this idea of nature and how it plays out in his work?
Sure. ARP, it'll get better.
Yeah, you're just warming up this week, sorry.
The first couple of questions, yeah. I'm going to be doing this.
Yeah.
During World War I, ARP was horrified by the violence and carnage that was really tearing apart the very place that he grew up and the cultures in which he grew up. And looking for an alternative, nature seemed an alternative to him that would be a great antidote for the sort of foolishness and arrogance of humanity that had led them into this mess, so to speak. ARP had already become very interested in abstract art before the war. He didn't want to imitate the appearance of nature, because imitating the appearance of nature, that's one thing that really the legacy of Western art had taught, been teaching artists how to do. And that was part of the system that seemed so flawed and kind of no longer helpful in the world he found himself living. And I think the idea of looking to nature, not so much the way it appeared, but the way it worked, its operations and principles, looking kind of below the surface of appearances, is something that he became very interested in. And during the war, these years of the 19-teens, he found various ways of expressing a connection to nature by the way in which he worked. Sometimes these were principles that you'd see in nature, such as bilateral symmetry.
Right.
But I think one of the things that really happened to him that he constantly went back to as a point of reference was a walk that he took, or maybe a series of walks, along the shores of a lake outside of Zurich, Switzerland. And he saw all kinds of flotsam and jetsam kind of cast up from on the shore. And he started making sketches from them and sort of sketches out of those sketches and developing really this whole kind of types of forms that were really inspired by the sort of random action of waves upon the shore. And it was out of these sort of forms that I think were really formed out of these forms that came out of the liquidity of the ink as much as what he's actually seeing, really kind of led him into this whole new language of a formal language that was both abstract and yet still seemed to suggest elements of the natural world.
I know that when I've learned a bit about our previously, people use this term biomorphic, not only about art, but other artists. And sometimes that term is used, you know, for anything that looks vaguely natural. But in the case of ARP, I mean, you just referred to the waves on the shore and things like this, this sense of like dynamism, energy, metamorphosis, change. It seems like that's it's not just about the form, but about the kind of energy or something like that. And that was part of his work for a while too, right?
I think that's a really important aspect of the work, really pretty much throughout his life, looking at trying to find an art that could change on its own or could surprise him as much as it might surprise a spectator. art that seemed to have a sort of natural sense of progression. It's hard not to use the word nature or natural when talking about it, but it's not very helpful, I think. But I think one of the things that ARP was looking for was a way to make art that also didn't just depend upon himself as a sort of great romantic artist.
Right, right.
Nature was also an alternative that offered a sense of humility that he felt really needed to be restored to the identity of the artist. At the same time, even though we really associate all these sort of fluid, natural forms with his work, there are other aspects of nature that kind of cut against that a little bit. He had a great interest in fragmentation, for example, and cutting and breaking things apart, and by association with entropy, the way that systems run down, or leaving things to chance, which is another way of sort of taking the creative process out of an artist's hands.
When you mentioned his interest in violence or fragmentation, cutting, and so on and so forth, it sounds like he sees that as a part of nature, essentially, more than it's not just about, say, the war, you know, human violence. Although I assume that's important, it's more this broader, deeper, natural thing. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a text that was published around 1920 that ARP wrote with two friends of his, and it's about the sort of art that he was hoping to make. He described wanting to make an art that was as natural as a bud bursting open, or a flower reproducing, or a stone breaking away from a cliff. And that kind of image, which, you know, it's an image of, we might think of it as violent, but it's not necessarily connected to death, because presumably a rock isn't going to feel pain when it splits off from a cliff. But I think he saw that as very much a part of things. At the same time, if somebody close to him passed away or was sick, he felt that very deeply. It doesn't necessarily mean that he accepted it fully within his own life.
Speaking of kind of his relationships and so forth, obviously the maybe central, or I assume maybe most important relationship with the artist, so Sophie Teuber, who he married and was Sophie Teuber Arp, who I know especially worked in textiles and collage. Could you just tell us a little bit about their collaboration, or kind of their artistic relationship with one another, with each other?
That's a fascinating topic.
I'm on that topic.
there are several books and there are several museum exhibitions devoted to it. Sophie Teuber Arp is a wonderful artist in her own right. One of the happy developments during the time I was preparing for this show was learning that there's going to be a retrospective of her work coming up in 2020, I believe. And so it in some ways sort of relieved me of the responsibility of needing to focus too much attention on her, because I really, it's great to consider them together, but I think it's also very helpful to try to tease them apart and consider them separately. One of the interesting things in working on ARP himself is that he is in some ways responsible for how closely we think about them in context with each other. They met in 1915 at an opening of his work in a group show, and he was already making sort of textiles, needlework and tapestries, and she had recently graduated from studying this particular type of work. And they became friends. They probably at some point during the teens or early 20s also began collaborating on works of art, collages and needlework particularly. She also would sometimes execute his designs for needleworks, because she had technically just a much greater skill than he did, and some of which has also led it to sometimes being difficult to tease out who did what in these bodies of work. Then after they got married, they got married in 1922, and really her career for a while, she was still teaching in Zurich and was supporting both of them, really, when he couldn't always sell work. They received in the mid-20s a commission for the decor of this entertainment complex in Strasbourg, which was ARP's home. It included designs for a movie theater, cafe, sort of dance hall. And the money they made from that project allowed them to buy a plot of land outside Paris, build a house that she designed, and it let her quit her job. And so it's really from the late 20s onward that she's able to really start asserting a much more independent identity as an artist. And so she is making reliefs as well as continuing to make some textile designs and collages. In the late 30s in particular, she and Arp collaborate on works together. Mm-hmm. That sort of group of works is one thing that we focused on in the exhibition. All along, Arp was supportive of her becoming a fine artist, but at the same time, she was still expected, and she also took it upon herself to run their household entertain. I think they had quite regularly on Sundays, they would have people over for dinners and discussions, and that all kind of just was expected she would be doing that. And that was, I think she enjoyed it, but it was also very frustrating to not have enough, feel like she had enough time for all this. Yeah. When World War II started, the two of them fled to the south of France. They were hoping to go to New York. They couldn't get the paperwork figured out. Uh-huh. Or they couldn't get the visas to line up. It was very complicated to try to get out. And they ended up going over into Switzerland since they both had connections there. And it was in 1943 in Switzerland. They were staying with friends and she went to bed early and she was sleeping in a room with a heater that apparently malfunctioned. And she died of carbon monoxide poisoning, which just absolutely, as you can imagine, devastated Arp. And it was really one of the singular blows of his life. And the ways he dealt with it, though, were very fascinating. One of which was he did organize a catalogue raisonné of her work. That's what he spent a lot of the 1940s doing. And he also began trying to give her a level of attention that she had not really received during her life. And so all of these wonderful reminiscences that are still a real important source of information about what it was like to be in the Dada movement and what it was like in Zurich in the 19-teens, he wrote almost all of those after her death. And that's also the years of their kind of early courtship. And so in many cases, he really emphasized the collaborative works they did together and the collaborative nature of their partnership. And there's not always corroborating contemporary evidence. And so one of the challenges for anybody working on both these artists is to respect that this was a real and I think substantial and rewarding partnership for both artists. But there was a lot of myth-making that occurred at a point where she couldn't speak up about it. It was no longer her voice being involved. Right. So I don't know if that quite answers your question. Well, it's a really complicated relationship.
It's so fascinating. And then I think you mentioned in the catalog that her death, the effect that it had on him in his art, his kind of reflection or coming to terms in the art that he was making. Could you talk a little bit about that, after her death?
Well, it took a couple of different directions. One direction was an interest in one place where you see an effect in Arp's work is the ways in which he found to carry on this collaboration.
Right.
And in fact, it was something that seemed to me an interesting enough and complicated enough topic that I asked one of the scholars that I asked to write for the catalog, Valburga Krupp, who is also going to be working on the Teuber Arp retrospective. I asked her to write about this idea of posthumous collaboration. There are a number of works that I think have been credited to Teuber Arp or have been kind of in this gray area where people didn't quite know what to do with them, where Arp took drawings or designs that she had made and had them executed as reliefs, for example, or as tapestries. And they weren't necessarily things that, we don't know that she would have wanted to do that. He was acting on a presumption that he thought that's what something she would have been interested in. Right. But it was also clearly, and it was something I think, it was something he thought he could do for her, but it was also a way of continuing this creative partnership, taking something she had created and rendering it in another format, which is in fact how he himself worked as an artist with his own reliefs, for example. He would take designs and have carpenters cut out the forms, and he would join them together, or in his later years he had other people join them together. Another effect that definitely came after World War II is there's a much greater interest in spirituality in his work of the, well, in the last two decades of his life. There's definitely an increased interest in the world beyond, and not surprisingly, more, or at least a consistent despair or contempt for humanity's brutality, which even without her death, I mean, having gone through two world wars. Yeah. And then there are also specific places where you can see him perhaps borrowing or being inspired by motifs in her work that and using it in his own work.
Wow. There's so much just on this general kind of theme of trying to interpret the way he interprets his past and kind of looking back layer on layer. It's such a fascinating kind of challenge, it sounds like. And I think you also wrote, I believe, how his, correct me if I have this wrong, but his use of chance, I guess, when around 1930, the surrealists were very interested in chance, and they were particularly interested in what he'd done and these collages arranged according to the laws of chance. But this was sometime after he had done it, and you know, there's what he was doing wasn't necessarily the same as what they were doing or the way he remembered it. And can you talk a little about kind of untangling that story?
Certainly. Yeah, I mean, when you talk about the legacy of ARP, right. Especially in his involvement in the Dada movement, something that comes up again and again is his use of chance.
On the general question of kind of interpreting the past and also interpreting ARP's interpretations of the past and the kind of layers of understanding there, I wanted to also ask you about the idea of chance, where, if I understand correctly, around 1930, when the Surrealists were very interested in chance from the Surrealist perspective, they were also interested in what ARP had done earlier with chance, but their interest and his weren't necessarily the same. And the way he was remembering and recalling what he'd done some years earlier was sort of a complicated situation. So I just wondered if you could talk about how you untangle all of those different aspects of it.
Certainly. I don't know that I've untangled them, or at least I can point to where the tangles are. Yeah, that was a particularly fascinating question for me, because ARP's Dada collages, which often are accompanied by such titles as Arranged According to the Laws of Chance, were terrifically influential on later generations of artists. Ellsworth Kelly, for example, visited ARP in his studio outside Paris, and was very taken with these chance collages and made chance collages of his own. The collages that ARP made during the Dada period that get these sort of chance titles attached to them, some of them were exhibited during that period, but there's no record of them being exhibited with titles or with any text or information that relates them to chance process.
Chance, right.
At the same time, you can say that nobody else was really making collages that looked like this, that had this sort of geometric grid that was tossed askew.
Yeah.
So I kind of reached the conclusion that it's altogether possible that ARP was experimenting with these kinds of chance processes. But I tend to believe that he hadn't theorized it at that point. I don't believe there were laws of chance at that point myself. And it was never so regularized as that kind of a process. I think for ARP, chance really meant moving things around in kind of an improvised way, and again finding a way to kind of short circuit his own ego, his own expectations. And I think, like almost every other modern artist, almost every other artist I know, he was concerned about getting credit for things that he had done early on, when there may not have been the same kind of audience that there was in Paris and the Surrealists at that point in the late 90s.
Something about that makes me think of Duchamp and his own efforts to, well, I guess probably many, many artists do this, but it just seems like in the case of work that's maybe especially cerebral or ephemeral or complicated or avant-garde, you know, something that takes a lot of effort to kind of take care of, that it seems like Duchamp was someone else who put a lot of effort into trying to make sure that what he'd done was cataloged and presented and remembered. But that's just what came to mind.
But. Well, I think, you know, I've also done work on Duchamp, and I thought of him regularly while I was working on ARP. There, it's rather different cases because I think ARP was sort of a more object-based artist in some ways than Duchamp, but that is, I think ARP made works that are easier to sort of categorize as sculpture, even though the relief sculptures are really meant, I think, to confuse our distinctions between paintings and sculptures. But one thing that I think needs to be better understood about ARP's work, and I think Duchamp is a useful point of reference in that regard, is that I think ARP was not so terribly interested in the original object. He seems, one source of some confusion in studies of ARP's work is the fact that he tended to feel comfortable remaking and refabricating things, which, if you're thinking about, say, a relief as a painting, which is supposed to be this unique object that has a certain value, that can be very worrying. But my tendency is to think that ARP thought of it as being much closer to the way Duchamp thought of his ready-mades. Yeah. That they would, you know, that you could, that it was the sort of the, that it was the concept of them that was the most important thing, and you could execute them in different ways.
Yeah.
And I think ARP was especially interested in seeing them. I think ARP was especially interested in seeing variations on his ideas. Yeah. I feel like Duchamp was open to variation when he produced replicas of ready-mades. But I think for ARP, part of the fun almost was editing and tinkering and messing around with it. And yet that it still had a kernel of the same idea that inspired it.
Well, as I wanted to also ask you about your expressionism in New York, and I thought as a kind of transition, I would ask you about ARP's reception in New York, and especially, you know, after World War II, and in this whole context of the rise of New York and all of this. Can you say a little bit about how his work was received in this country?
Yeah, it's really interesting, and it speaks, I think, to not just the importance of ARP's work overall, which I think we've lost sight of a little bit today, how historically significant it was for a large number of artists, but also the fact that ARP's importance kind of came in waves, depending on what work was being shown. So, for example, with the abstract expressionists, artists like de Kooning or Gorky or Pollock, the works that I think was really important for them to see were ARP's Dada reliefs and his reliefs of the 20s, which were shown in New York in the 1930s and at Art of the Century at Peggy Guggenheim's gallery in the early 40s. And that kind of amoeboid, what you were referring to as biomorphic, this form that seems to be abstract and yet still suggest a form, you see that all over the place.
Was that what was the ARP shape? Was that the term?
Yes, it's what Alfred H. Barr called the ARP shape that pops up in many, many works of that period, and in fact was so influential that it kind of obscured, I think, later on the fact that this came from ARP ultimately. That was one wave, and another aspect of interest was ARP's work in collage, which was particularly important for Robert Motherwell. What interested Motherwell, the collages that most interested Motherwell, interestingly, were the collages that ARP started making around 1930, around this time of revival of interest among the surrealists in chance and also in collage itself. ARP apparently, again, according to the story that he told, he found a group of his early collages that had started to deteriorate, and he tore them up and made collages from them. And this tearing of paper, the papier déchiré, became really, on the one hand, a technique that ARP used to make work for the rest of his life. And then in turn, that work, when it was seen in New York in the 40s, was enormously important to Robert Motherwell. And his practice of collage bears a fairly large debt to ARP's example. So that's kind of one aspect of ARP's impact on American artists. I spoke already of Ellsworth Kelly a bit. And I think, you know, the other thing that Kelly liked about ARP's work, and that speaks also to his impact on the next generation of American artists, I think Kelly was also looking for a way of making art that wasn't self-expressive. And ARP's connecting of his work to nature, one of the things that he wrote about and he said in various contexts, is that he described, you know, the fact that you can have a field of flowers and they can all be the same species. So they're all the same, but they're all different. And I think that kind of concept of repetition and variation is something that was very appealing to Kelly also. He's in relation to ARP's work, he has said something similar. Yeah. And in him, he found a way to use nature in his work that, again, was not about resemblance. Interestingly, after World War II, the works by ARP that began to be shown more frequently were his sculptures in the round. And those works tended to be so highly finished to New York eyes. You know, ARP's reliefs always have kind of smooth edges and they're very cleanly painted, but there's always something kind of clunky and awkward and a little chunky about them. The sculptures looked like they hadn't been touched by anybody. And the abstract expressionists really did not like that. De Kooning made this comment that De Kooning preferred the shoes of Van Gogh to the pebbles of ARP. That kind of thing. But it took an artist like Donald Judd looking at ARP's work to see something, to see the value and to look at ARP's sculpture and see why he was working that way. When Judd was writing reviews in the early 60s, he reviewed a show at the Sydney Janus Gallery, and he talked about how the smooth finish of ARP's works allows you to see works. It allows you to see the sculptures as a whole, and that you have to have this kind of blandness and smoothness to be able to kind of almost have this gestalt experience of the singular form. Right. And that, of course, was very encouraging to Judd, who was just then also trying to develop a similar effect in his own work.
I imagine that your research in the book on Neo-Dada might have helped set the stage for your interest in ARP. And then I wanted to ask you about kind of the origins of the book, or how you started or conceived this project on Neo-Dada and abstract expressionism, to go back.
Yeah, that really goes back, because it goes back to my dissertation topic. Yeah. Although the book became so different that I think there's only maybe 2 out of 12 chapters that overlap with the dissertation. The way I got to the dissertation topic, I think, really continues to feed the work that I do. I really wanted to write a dissertation on a topic on surrealism. And I spent a summer, you know, kind of reading and looking for a topic and reading stuff. And I was reading at some point older catalogs, things like Alfred Barr's Fantastic Art, Dada Surrealism, and Robert Motherwell's The Dada Painters and Poets. And I kept noticing, it's almost like static or interference when you're getting a radio station or something. I kept getting little flickers of their present moment. Like there'd be references to what was going on in art that was contemporary to them. Uh-huh. And I started getting kind of curious about why this was happening, why this was being seen in terms of their present rather than looking at it as their past. And in talking about it and thinking about it and then discussing it with my advisor, there sort of came the idea of like, well, maybe that's a good topic. Maybe that's worth delving into. And that's kind of where it started, like looking at this period. And originally I was trying to cast the net a lot wider and have it be kind of the 40s through the 60s and be Dada and surrealism. And I started working on Dada and it became so big that the surrealism kind of dropped out. And by the time I finished my dissertation, and this is what I always tell people who are writing dissertations, tell students, is that I said, if you're lucky, by the time you get to the end of your dissertation, you'll know what you really want to write about. Right. And you just get the dissertation done and then you can kind of do what you want. And by the time I had finished my dissertation, I had found a couple of sources that I wasn't able to delve into that was really from back in the 40s. Mainly, I found a couple of uses of the term Neo-Dada, like way back around 1950, 51, referring to Pollock's work. And that kind of blew my mind. Yeah. And so the book kind of started with trying to answer that question of like, what did that... Because one of the things I've found or felt I found in my dissertation is that neo-dada in the 50s and 60s, when it started to be used to describe the work of artists like Jasper Johns and Robert Rauschenberg and Cy Twombly, it really wasn't helpful to treat it as if it were some kind of historical term created by historians. It was something that kind of circulated in gossip, and it was kind of a criticism. And the historical stuff kind of accrued to it as it gained currency, as other people kind of outside this conversation started trying to make sense of it. And so a lot of the work I did early on was in trying to figure out, what did people think Dada was, and how were they using it to hold contemporary art accountable through the use of this term neo-Dada. And so ARP kind of figured in that early research.
And he came
to figure in the research that fed into the book. The other thing that fed into the book was my dissertation was largely kind of historiographic. It was like a survey of criticism and art reviews of the time and things like that. And I really wanted to write about objects and write about artists. And so I kind of consciously set out with the book to try to do those two things. And what I got to and where those things came together was in writing about artists who were also functioning as critics and historians. Robert Motherwell's work as an editor on the Dada Painters and Poets was really key, I think, to the way Dada was received in the United States. And it was shaped by his own artistic concerns. And at the same time, it also had an impact on his own artistic concerns.
Yeah.
And what you were talking about with Duchamp earlier, you know, at the exact same time, Duchamp is also trying to take steps to kind of ensure his artistic legacy at the same time that a new movement is emerging in art that he really doesn't like at all.
There are so many different kind of interesting angles to it. I thought about how there's a lot of times if you learn about, I guess, some of the dominant figures of the 40s and 50s, they're such a in terms of the history, you might learn that at that time there was such a focus on painting as a medium and abstraction, whether it's Clement Greenberg or kind of Alfred Barra and William Rubin and Cezanne and then Picasso, and it's all of these questions about, you know, what is painting and what is painting for and how painting is the central thing. But then by focusing on Motherwell, I mean, who is a painter, but there's all this other aspects to it. And I guess you point out that the phrase Dada painters might be almost sort of paradoxical, but Dada was important to him and to people who he was working with in a way that these other people didn't recognize necessarily.
Yeah, I think even in that period, there Dada has several different meanings depending on who's talking about it and when.
Because
even Motherwell, I think, was very conflicted about Dada. He really despised its destructiveness, but he really appreciated the kind of ethical position that led them, or led some of them, to be that anti-art about everything. And I think that's also one of the most interesting things about working on Dada, that in some ways, because Dada was a movement that was really so much in protest against what at that time of the early 20th century was one of the most horrible wars yet to occur, in that regard it became a real touchstone, a point of reference, both for its sort of ethical purity, but also for its failures for this later generation also going through a world war. I think also because Dada kind of got thrown around and used to label all kinds of experimental things, as you said, well beyond painting. The same thing kind of happens with the term neo-Dada, where it becomes the term of choice for all these really interesting and exciting developments in the art world that don't have names at first, because in addition to the work of artists like Rauschenberg and Johns, pop art is initially called neo-Dada.
Right.
Early forms of minimalism and happenings and installation art and conceptual art, they all at some time or another get this label bestowed upon them.
I'd heard previously the term in the context of Rauschenberg and Johns, but no, I hadn't that year. Describing. But so then another transition in the same period in the Melvin Edwards work, whose retrospective Five Decades you created a couple of years ago, an artist who had some years in New York but has also been in different places. For him, I wanted to start by asking a little bit about his background and kind of his early years. And I read in your catalog that he'd been a very serious and talented football player as a kid. And I thought that's sort of interesting because we often have these stereotypes that the artists and the football players are sort of different people. But then I thought, well, you know, like Matthew Barney was also a football player. And mm-hmm. I wonder, that I think you quoted Edwards that the kind of grace and athleticism, and I can't remember the details, that somehow the physicality and the coordination and beauty of football was important for him.
But yeah, initially I had a couple of different opportunities to see Edwards' work. I first became familiar with it really when I was working on a permanent collection installation at the Metropolitan Museum, which was before I came to the Nasher. And this was a show that we called Paper Trails, and it was artists who worked with paper as a material rather than just as a support. And they had a couple of works by Edwards that we included, and in the process of working on that show and doing didactics, and I was looking into his sculptures, and I hadn't really been very familiar with his work. And at that point, I don't think he'd really had, or I wasn't aware, which is probably more likely, that he'd had an exhibition recently. And shortly after I joined the Nasher, I made a trip to Los Angeles where I saw this incredible exhibition called Now Dig This,
right,
which is black art in Los Angeles from the 60s to 1980, I think. And he was a prominent part of that exhibition, and it really blew me away. And what really moved me about his work is, you know, because of the work I had already done on mid-century American art, I was really quite familiar with the syntax and technique of welded metal sculptures.
Right.
I knew it from, you know, of course, from David Smith and, you know, back further, Gonzalez, and slightly more recently, that of John Chamberlain or Richard Stankiewicz. So, yeah, there's this lineage that this artist
right.
is supposed to fit into. But I felt like I was seeing work that was, it fit, but it didn't fit. It was like taking this kind of language and using it to very different means. It was really concentrated, it used scale in a way that I hadn't seen before.
Uh-huh.
And having just joined the Nasher Sculpture Center, my first thought was, wouldn't it be amazing to present some of that work there?
Yeah.
And I had largely been an independent scholar up till then. I mean, I had worked in museums at different times, but I think
right.
I was somewhat naive in some ways.
Uh-huh.
And to my own, and sometimes that being naive is good,
right.
because my first thought was like, oh, there must be somebody organizing a show of this work, because I remembered from the previous research I'd done
right.
that there'd been a retrospective in 1993. I thought, somebody's bound to be doing
right.
a survey, so maybe we can become a venue.
Right.
And I went to talk to his dealer on a trip to New York and found out nobody was doing that. And it just sort of struck me that I could,
yeah.
we could do this.
Yeah,
you know, if the artist wanted
yeah.
us to do that. And so I met him and we talked about it, and that was sort of the genesis of that project. And it's something, first of all, it was just a tremendously rewarding experience.
Yeah.
It was terrific to, and I feel very privileged to have spent as much time with an artist of such thoughtfulness and intelligence and talent as Melvin Edwards. And I was also really happy to be able to present the work in the Nasher. And I think one of the things that was interesting to me and sobering, and it also demonstrates to me sometimes the difference between academic work and museum work, and that's not very good. It's not a very good distinction, but in writing a book like An Audience of Artists, which was published by a university press, I'm on the one hand very interested in how stories get told, like
yeah.
the stories we know about history or the canon or how that gets made. And so in that book, I really focused on canonical artists, Marcel Duchamp, Robert
right.
Motherwell, Jackson Pollock, Barnett Newman.
Right.
Those were the four main artists in that book. And occasionally people ask me if I would like to make an exhibition out of that book. I thought, well, would I really want to do that?
Right,
and
right.
I've always thought that it wouldn't be such an interesting exhibition, and I still think that. But I think part of that Part of the reason for that, though, is that when it comes to the presentation of shows in museums, there are still so many different stories to be told.
Right, right.
And that feature artists who are not already part of the stories we already know. Yeah. So I guess I see it as like two sides of the same project. One is that you have to investigate how things got to be the way they are. And then you have to also try to see what you want to, how you want to change that. And it can't just be a matter of adding to it. It has to be in conversation with it. And I think that's been important to me about the work I did on the Melvin Edwards retrospective, is that it was, I think for me, I kind of personally or selfishly, it was a chance to exercise that other aspect of what I think has to be part of a larger historical project. Does that make sense?
Sure. No, definitely. I can. Yeah. I thought it was interesting that, I guess, around 1970, his exhibition at the Whitney Museum in New York, that there were calls for Black artists in particular to commit to like kind of explicitly militant kinds of work, but there were artists like Edwards and Frank Bowling and others who said, who were still in abstraction along with social relevance and social concern. And it seems like Edwards, there's always been this balance of different aspects to it. You can just look at it as out of an interest in welded steel as a medium and David Smith and so on and so forth, or you can reflect on the social realities he's talking about, and that combination seems really powerful.
I think that's one of the strongest aspects of his work, and I think it is characteristic of a small circle of artists who he knew at that time. I'm also thinking, I think Jack Whitten operated very much the same way, that, you know, you would start talking to one of them about social meaning of their work and they would switch gears on you and start talking about the formal the formal properties, and vice versa. I think it was an extraordinarily challenging time anyway.
Yeah.
But I think artists in their positions must have felt really pulled in a lot of different directions. And the ones who were really good were able to somehow fuse it together into works that are really, that operate on multiple levels in ways that are really, I don't know, just really stimulating and really satisfying.
I guess the example of his use of barbed wire, you know, there's in Texas, there's barbed wire in ranches. And I learned in the catalog that his farmhouse in New York, there was barbed wire around there. But then, of course, at the same time, the much more kind of menacing and sinister lynching or concentration camps, or it seems like it's like the specific meanings are there, especially with the title of the whole series called Lynch Fragments, that makes it completely explicit, pointing to a specific social history. But somehow, I guess, as you're saying, the form of the work isn't kind of didactic. He's not trying to narrate a specific event, but work in a more kind of connotative or suggestive way. It's really, really interesting. I guess that's not a question either.
The question is.
It sounded like in the 70s, well, there was his Whitney show, there was his show at the Studio Museum. It sounded like their public reception was in some ways not what it would have wanted to be. But then by the 1980s, there was a kind of younger generation of African American artists, and his work started to get more. And I was kind of wondering how that happened, or what was going on that made it seem have less of a public in the 70s and then more in the 80s?
I think that's a pretty complicated, or it's a question that has a lot of different strands to it.
Right.
Because I think part of it is about gallery representation and collectors and having curators who are willing to show things. At some point, I think right before the show, the Nasher show opened, maybe around the time of Now Dig This, there was a story on him in the New York Times, and it was, the title of the article was something like, you know, the artist who's on the verge of being rediscovered again.
Right.
And I think I'm not sure how to answer that question. I think the thing that's admirable to me is that he's gone on with the work regardless, and that occasionally the work has been, he's been making really strong work even if he hasn't had say, regular gallery representation.
Right. So it sounds like, I guess in the 70s, there were a number of African-American artists and others who were interested in traveling to Africa and visiting Africa for the first time and learning something. It was very interesting to me that Edwards has, he's made kind of a long-term permanent presence there, and he's done years of serious work there, and there have been elements in his own work. You know, it's not just kind of a tourist thing, but it's become a major part of his work. So could you talk about kind of what role Africa, or his time and his work, what role that plays in his mm-hmm. work?
I think it's terrifically important to him, and has been a mainstay in his work almost from the beginning. One of the things that was educational for me, among many things, was learning from him that even in the 60s, even before he went to Africa for the first time, I think in 1970, but, you know, there were African-American publications that also carried articles about what was going on in other parts of the world, in African, you know, what was struggles for independence and liberation in African countries were very much seen in parallel with the civil rights movement in the United States. People who were interested about these things had a mission was accessible to people who were interested in these topics. I think something that really contributed to Edwards' involvement in Africa was his relationship with his second wife, Jane Cortez, who was a really important poet and writer who was also very connected with and interested in Africa. And they're, you know, they traveled there together, I think, when they, I think the establishing of a house in Senegal was a decision on both, something they were both interested in pursuing. And I think for Edwards in particular, being being somebody who works with welded metal, I think he sees himself very much in the line of a tradition with blacksmiths.
Yeah.
And of course, there's a very strong tradition of that in parts of Africa. And that's been something I think he's really sought out and pursued when he's been there.
Yeah.
And he had a Fulbright in 1989, 1990 to work in Zimbabwe and made tremendous work there and also taught. He's a very gregarious person. Feels like wherever you are, you will meet somebody who has some connection to Melvin Edwards. But that's really helped him in, I think he feels very connected to Africa in ways that are, you know, they're genuine and that they're rooted in really engagements with real people and real places. And those are also people who, you know, travel to the United States. They travel to New York, where he's been based since the late 60s.
It's so it's so interesting. Let me just close by asking if you could tell us a little bit about what you're currently working on or what's coming up.
It's been funny since the Nature of Art opened at the Nasher, and people say, well, what's next? What's next is the Nature of Art.
Yes,
because it is opening at the Peggy Guggenheim Collection in Venice in April, and I'll be going over in a little under 2 months to oversee the installation, and I've been working on that. And so that's still very much in my brain. And I have several other exhibition projects coming up at the Nasher. With ARP completed, I'm also thinking about sort of the next big historical thing.
In the case of, for example, the Nasher Exchange, you've worked with artists to on kind of site-specific work elsewhere in Dallas. And I just wanted to ask how you think about the space that you're working with, especially I guess in the case of sculpture, where it's not just, you're not just thinking about the walls, but you're really thinking about the space. How do you kind of approach that challenge when you're thinking about how to put work into a space?
What we do at the Nasher, we're kind of old school in that we use models. There are software programs that you can also use for this. Especially since it's sculpture, I find it useful to have the kind of 3D thing lying out there, laying it out. And that's what I've been doing for the Peggy Guggenheim installation, because it's 11 small rooms as opposed to the Nasher's larger spaces. And you just start moving. You have to do... The That's kind of what it comes down to. You have to just start, if you're working with a model, you just have to start moving things around and see what works. And it was much easier for me to do that once we had the show installed at the Nasher, because I knew how much space things really took up. The thing that's very daunting about a show like ARP is a number of works in the show had couriers. And when couriers come, they supervise the installation of the work, which means you can't tweak it afterwards. So we had to really see that I had to be sure at the very beginning that all the pedestals were in exactly the right place. And as much as I could, where everything else was going to hang on the walls and so forth. When you're working with contemporary artists, it's a little bit different because there does tend to be more flexibility, which is good. If it's new work, there can always be things that you don't foresee, which also happens with older work as well. And that was one thing that was interesting with the Melvin Edwards show, because it traveled to two other museums. And in both places, we reconfigured the barbed wire pieces differently.
Right.
And in those cases, it was mainly him coming in and talking with the curator and with me about where various pieces, where they could go or how we could reconfigure them to meet the needs of that space. But I really enjoy that. It's a little nerve-wracking until you know how it's all going to fit. But
Our guest today is Catherine Kraft, who's curator most recently of The Nature of ARP, which will open at the Peggy Guggenheim Collection in Venice in April.